Shalom, everyone. I'm Josiah Jeffrey.
I'm Hosea Jeffrey.
And we're back discussing the Torah portions. This week, we're looking at the portion of Shoftim, which goes from Deuteronomy 16, 18 through 21, 9. We've already read the portion ahead of time, so if you'd like to read it as well, why don't you go ahead and pause the video and do that, and then we'll go ahead and get into discussing.
In Shoftim, Moses gives the people of Israel a variety of instructions to guide them after his death, including how they should conduct warfare, how to respond to difficult legal situations, and who will lead Israel after Moses dies, including the coming prophet like Moses, who will guide them with the words of God.
So this portion begins with Moses talking to the people again about the judges that are going to be placed over the people of Israel. He starts out by giving some rules for the judges themselves and how they're supposed to render their judgments over Israel. So Moses' instructions to the judges aren't really new here. We've already covered them previously in Deuteronomy and in the book of Leviticus and back in the book of Exodus. So he's talked about the judges a lot, saying that the judges really need to be impartial and they need to render their judgments fairly no matter what's happening. Moses specifically cautions the judges against taking bribes. And he says, "You shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice, or righteousness and only righteousness, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which Adonai your God is giving you." So I just found the wording here that Moses uses really interesting, because it's basically saying that a bribe can distort how you view things. It can change everything. And instead of going after bribes, the people of Israel need to pursue only justice, only righteousness. That should be all that they're going for. And so I think that a good principle that we can all draw from this is that when things are playing on our own fleshly desires, that can pull us away from what is righteous and good and just. And so we need to be careful to not allow temptations to play on our desires, and we should seek only righteousness, seek only justice, seek only what God's word says. Put that first and only in our lives and not fall for things playing on what we want for ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, we've been saying it over and over again. You've got to love Adonai with your whole heart and with your whole soul. You're supposed to only seek and follow after him. God has given us his standards of righteousness, and he wants us to pursue that righteousness, to pursue his word, his commands, which are good and righteous. If instead we accept bribes, we are becoming lovers of money. And when we love money or any kind of incentive to turn away from justice, we're loving that instead of loving God and his rules. So once again, the greatest command, love God. And if you follow that, then you will not accept any bribes. You will follow justice and only justice.
And Moses goes on to talk about how the people of Israel need to bring their cases to the judges and then do whatever those judges say. So Moses specifically says that when there is a case that is too difficult for the people of Israel, then they need to go to the place where Adonai chooses, which is where the Mishkan or tabernacle or temple is set up, which, as we discussed in a previous portion, that's Jerusalem is the place. And there they need to bring the case to the priest or to the judge who is sitting in judgment in those days. So we had read in previous portions that Moses had set up judges at varying levels throughout the people of Israel, over tens and 50s and 100s and whatever. And so this is basically seeming like if a case is so difficult that it goes through all the different tiers of judges, then they need to bring it straight to the capital of Israel, straight to the place where God puts his name, and bring it straight to the priest and to the judge. Not just any judge, the judge. This seems to be describing the same kind of judge as was over the people of Israel in the period of the judges in the book of Judges. There would be a specific person who is in charge, basically, and so he and the priest would be the ones that would receive all of the most important, most difficult cases in all of Israel.
Moses is showing here that after he's gone and the people of Israel have gone into the land, Israel is not going to be run by a single man leading Israel. Instead, he's showing that there's going to be a specific judge that God is going to appoint, but then he's going to be kind of sharing power with the priests. But more than that, this system is very non-centralized. The people of Israel are expected, for the most part, to just follow the Torah. They can handle it themselves unless there's a situation that's especially difficult. And then they go to the judge for a specific answer. It's not the judge's job to set forth decrees or make the laws. Moses is already giving them the law which comes from God today. So the Torah is really all the people need on a day-to-day basis. The judge's job is to guide the people of Israel when they encounter difficulties with following the Torah. And the priests are supposed to do that too. We had talked before about how the priests have a job to guard knowledge, to know the Torah, and to teach it to the people of Israel. So together with the judges, the priest's job is not to rule the people, but to lead the people in following God's rule.
So even though the system of government that is established for Israel in the Torah is very decentralized, as Hosea said, at the same time, the priest and the judge are the highest authority in the land, except for, of course, the Torah itself. But as far as people go, the priest and the judge are the highest authorities. And Moses says to the people, according to the terms of the law or the Torah, which they teach you, according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you, to the right or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve Adonai your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. So Moses makes it very clear that violating the word of the priest or the judge is a big deal, and it is worthy of death if you just blatantly disregard what they judge. We've already seen throughout the Torah that God appointed Moses, and whenever people were resisting Moses, they were actually resisting God, because it was God's authority behind everything that Moses was saying. And so Moses is basically saying, especially with him being gone, that authority is going to be, in part, transferred down to the priests and to the judges. And so anything that they say, their word is law, quite literally. And so you have to do what they say, otherwise you are going to be disregarding God's rulings. Even though the Torah lays out a decentralized form of government for Israel, God is not advocating for anarchy. He's advocating for a Torah-driven society led by the priest and the judge.
So next, Moses describes what needs to happen if the people of Israel decide to set up a king to rule over them. Like we were saying before, the system that Moses has prescribed here is decentralized. There's a judge and there's the priests who together help the people of Israel in knowing what the Torah says, but they don't actually make the laws, they just judge the people of Israel based on the Torah. This is very different from how the other nations around them did things. Most nations around them had kings by this time. The king is just one man that all the people put in charge, and then he made the rules. He made the laws, he commanded the people, and everyone had to listen to him. And so Moses here makes provision for when the people of Israel decide to set up a king. He says, when you come to the land that Adonai your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you whom Adonai your God will choose. So even though Moses is making a provision for this, he's not saying it's the right thing for Israel to do. But he knows they will, so he's going ahead and coming up with the rules. We had already talked about how the Torah is what makes Israel different from all the other nations. The legal system that Israel is run on is an immediate identifier. Israel's not like any of the other nations. Their God is not like any of the other nations. And so under the judges system, the people of Israel are being governed directly by that Torah, directly with God as the one making the rules. And this makes Israel different. But instead, they want to be like all the other nations. And so in a way, they are rejecting that distinction that having the Torah as their only legal code makes between Israel and all the other nations. Instead, they're saying, we want our legal code to be defined by kings. We want to be like all the other nations. And so they're losing that separateness, which the Torah's uniqueness makes for the people of Israel. So even though this is not the system that Moses is saying should be in place, he's making provision for it, and he's actually basically prophesying, because the people of Israel will later do this exact thing after hundreds of years of being ruled by judges in the manner Moses just prescribed. They will say in the time of the judge Samuel, give us a king to rule us so that we may be like all the nations. Now, when the people of Israel did this, God was actually very upset because God says he is supposed to be the king over Israel. He's the one who brought them out of Egypt. He's the one who rules over them. He's the one who gave them the Torah. He makes the rules for Israel. Mm. So he is the rightful king. And so when the people of Israel ask for a human king, they are actually trying to replace and reject God. Mm. Now, it's worth noting here that even though Moses is making this provision that they could have kings and it's not recommended, he's still saying, even if you do pick a king, it has to be a king that God chooses. Mm. So that's exactly what did happen. When the people cried to Samuel for a king, God told Samuel, I am picking a man who will be king over the people of Israel. And first he picked Saul, who turned out to not be faithful to God's rules. And so he replaced him with David. David is the king that God chose. And he not only chose David, but because he found David to be faithful, he chose his descendants after him forever. So even though this wasn't necessarily the recommended thing for Israel to do, God still went along with it and planned accordingly and chose to make a covenant with David and chose a line of kings. And now Israel does have a line of kings which finds its fulfillment in Yeshua.
I find it very interesting here that Moses is basically making provisions for when the people of Israel abandon how the Torah works. He's providing a way for Torah to still work even as the people of Israel are rejecting the system that God himself set up. It's crazy. But God has that foresight. He has that power and authority. And so he has a way to make sure that Israel will kind of stay on track if they really, really do want to get back on track after they set up a king. And that is what happens through David. In David's reign, the people of Israel were faithful to the Torah.
And of course, under Yeshua's rule, the people of Israel will be faithful to the Torah. This is not only a provision for when they start to go astray to give them a little bit of wiggle room. This actually leads them back to the Torah. Because they did this, because they set up a king, God was able to set up David, make that covenant with David, bring the messianic line, and bring the Messiah, who will make the new covenant with the house of Israel, write the Torah on their hearts. So even though this was in some ways a deviation from the system that Moses set up, it also leads straight back to God's will, God's commands, and God's holy Torah.
I think that perfectly sums up everything about Yeshua, which is that God set up the path back to him and Israel went astray. And God's like, here's Yeshua. Here's how Israel can get back on track, back to being the way that God wanted them to be. In fact, one of the rules that Moses gives for the king here is that the king is supposed to make his own handwritten copy of the Torah and keep it with him. He's supposed to write it under the supervision of the priests, so to make sure that he's writing the Torah correctly. And then he has his own personal copy that he wrote every single word down so that he knows the whole thing. And that's supposed to guide him as he's judging the people of Israel. So God is making sure that if Israel does, and when Israel does, set up a king in opposition to what God laid out in his Torah, he is providing the way back to him through the Torah, through the king leading the people of Israel in the ways of God's Torah. And I think that this is also somewhat similar in some ways to the pattern that we see over and over again in the book of Deuteronomy, where Moses is laying out the curses that the people of Israel will get if they abandon the Torah. We see in the book of Samuel that when they say, we're going to pick a king, God tells Samuel to tell them, the king is going to be awful. He's going to rule over you harshly. Are you sure you really want to do this? And they say, yeah, bring on the king. And so they end up getting that punishment. But then God does use it to bring Israel back to him in the end. In the same way, with all of the curses that are in the Torah, that's not a final one and done, you broke the Torah and now it won't work again anymore. The curses are always meant to bring Israel back to God. It's correction, and it brings Israel back into righteousness, back into following God as they should. So even the curses of the Torah, and even this kingdom that doesn't match the Torah system, it's not a way of God saying, I'm done with the Torah, I'm getting rid of it. It's a condition that's enacted in order to bring Israel back into alignment with God's will.
Moses then gives a short set of rules for the inevitable king that the people of Israel set up to follow. He says, he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses. Since Adonai has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. And once again, Moses seems to be prophesying here because a very specific king of Israel, King Solomon, the son of King David, broke every single one of these rules. He acquired tens of thousands of horses, many of them coming directly from Egypt. And of course, he acquired 300 wives and 700 concubines.
Oy.
And excessive amounts of silver and gold. Every single one of his drinking vessels was gold, and he had so much silver that it says that in his kingdom, silver was considered as nothing. So despite Solomon's wisdom, he broke all of these rules, and what do you know, just as Moses warned, they turned his heart away. He went following after other gods because he filled his life with all these riches, these horses and silver and gold and women. All of these things filled up his heart with something other than Adonai his God, turned his heart to something else, and because he wasn't fully faithful, because he went astray, there were kingdom-sized ramifications. The kingdom was split in two. The northern tribes were lost. Some of the idols that he set up remained in place in Jerusalem until the time of King Josiah, one of the last kings of Judah, centuries later. And so ultimately, because of Solomon's unfaithfulness and the unfaithfulness of his sons, the entire people of Israel ended up going into exile. And we still haven't all returned. The kingdom and nation has not been restored. And until the time that Yeshua comes back, it won't be. And so Solomon perfectly illustrates why Moses' commands here were so important. And this is also the problem with the entire monarchy system. By putting the authority in the hands of one man as king, if he isn't faithful to the Torah, he leads the whole nation astray. The whole nation has to suffer the consequences of his sin. And so Moses is instructing the king, you have to be faithful to the Torah. You have to know the Torah. You have to love God with your whole heart. Put nothing else in the way. And so this shows that in order for the monarchy to work, the king of Israel has to be perfect. He has to be sinless. And so that's exactly what Yeshua does, what no other king could do. And so he is the fulfillment of these commands, of the covenant with David, and of the Torah. He is the only one who is able to lead Israel and give the commands of God as his commands, because he is God. And so unlike the kings who sinned, who brought the whole nation into their sin, when Yeshua is king over his people in righteousness, he will bring the whole nation into his righteousness.
Now, continuing along the same vein of who is going to be leading the people of Israel, whether that's the priests and the judges or whether that's the king, Moses says that Adonai is going to raise up someone else that the people of Israel need to obey. He says he's going to raise up a prophet like Moses. So as Moses is here basically saying, I'm going to be dying, and so here's who's going to lead you going forward, this is the ultimate fulfillment of who is going to be replacing Moses after he's gone. Moses says, Adonai your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen or your brothers. You shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of Adonai your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of Adonai my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore, or I will die. Adonai said to me, they have spoken well. I will raise up a prophet from among your countrymen like you, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words, which he, the prophet like Moses, shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. So Moses here is being very specific. He's not just talking about prophets in general. He's not just saying there will be prophets from among your brothers. He's saying there will be a prophet from among your brothers who is like me, a specific prophet like Moses. And Moses harkens back to all the way back at Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb when God spoke the Ten Commandments to the people. And then the people said, all right, Moses, from now on, we don't want to hear from God directly anymore. This is nuts. This is crazy. And we're going to die. Moses, you need to hear God's words directly, and then you can tell them to us. And God's like, that's exactly right. That's exactly what we're going to do. Moses, you're going to be the intermediary, and you're going to hear my words face to face and repeat them to the people. But God is saying more than that. He's going to raise up another prophet like Moses. He's going to fulfill the exact same capacity as Moses. As we read back in the book of Numbers, back in chapter 12, we discussed how God specifically made a distinction between Moses and other prophets. Moses was completely different from other prophets in that he heard God's words face to face, and he heard the words straight from God's mouth. Other prophets would hear from God in visions and dreams, but Moses spoke to God face to face as a man speaks to his friend. No other prophet in Israel's history was ever that close to God. And so, whereas most prophets simply act as a mouthpiece for God, which as we see here, the prophet like Moses is still a mouthpiece for God. God's putting his words in the prophet like Moses' mouth. But at the same time, other prophets don't speak to God face to face like Moses did on Mount Horeb. A prophet like Moses is in the unique capacity to mediate between God and the people of Israel. We saw multiple times throughout the Torah how Moses turned away God's wrath and reasoned with God, and how Moses spoke God's words to the people, and how Moses relayed the people's words to God, and how Moses, in that capacity, was the one who mediated the covenant of the Torah. He made the sacrifice that gave the blood of the covenant and then enjoined the people of Israel nationally to God's covenant. Moses is absolutely 100% unique. There is no other prophet like him in these regards, except for the Master Yeshua. This is one of the most significant and direct prophecies about Yeshua in the Torah, where Moses is saying that another prophet, Yeshua is a prophet, and he's going to be like Moses. The Master Yeshua did speak to God face to face. He's the Son of God, and he had glory with God even in the beginning, before the foundation of the world. And he speaks the words which the Father told him to say. And additionally, the Master Yeshua, he is the one mediator between God and man. He stands between us and God for everybody. And he's in a unique capacity to do that, even more so than Moses was. Moses had to go into the earthly tent of meeting, but Yeshua goes into the heavenly Mishkan, the heavenly tabernacle, to mediate between us and God. And in this capacity, the Master Yeshua was also able to shed the blood of the covenant, his own blood, and enjoin the people of Israel and all the nations who will call on him to enjoin them into the new covenant that was prophesied about by Jeremiah and Isaiah and Ezekiel. Only Moses and the prophet like Moses are capable of enjoining the entire nation of Israel to a covenant. And inasmuch that God promised that there would be another national covenant for the people of Israel, a new national covenant, so also God had to send another prophet like Moses to enjoin that covenant. And since it's a greater covenant, it's an even greater mediator. The prophet like Moses is even greater than Moses himself.
It's very noteworthy that Moses harkens back to this story at Horeb here. Because when we read this back in Exodus, the people of Israel asked for a mediator. And God said, okay, I'm giving you Moses. But the way Moses tells it here, the people of Israel ask for a mediator. And God says, okay, I am giving you the prophet like Moses. Mm. The way Moses tells it here, God's promise to send a prophet like Moses is not a direct response to Moses needing a successor. On the contrary, this was the very moment when Moses was picked. Mm. And so even from the beginning of Moses' work, there was already someone like him being prepared. And the reason why is because the people needed a mediator. That is the root problem, and that is not a temporary problem. It did not cease to be a problem after Moses. And so by God promising a successor to Moses in this way, God is illustrating that the people's need for someone like Moses is eternal. They need to constantly have a prophet like Moses, which means even the people who came after Moses, like Joshua, were not able to fulfill this role. In fact, Joshua is never even called a prophet, and he was not a mediator. Yes, God did sometimes speak to him, but as Moses instructed him, he was to go to the priest to receive counsel from God. So he himself needed a mediator rather than being the mediator. So in order to fulfill the requirements here, Moses is saying that he is going to have a single successor who is a prophet and a mediator who can fulfill this role indefinitely so that the people of Israel will always have their request that they asked for at Horeb fulfilled through him. And then the other thing about this prophet like Moses is that the people of Israel need to listen to him. He is in authority. This is different from the dual judge-priest system that Moses prescribed originally, a system which was basically in place as soon as Joshua and Eleazar led the people of Israel into the land. Before them, Moses led the people on his own. Aaron was there to help him, yes, but Moses was clearly the one in charge, the one with both mediator and prophet and ruler and judge capacity. And so the system under Moses, and then in turn under this single prophet like Moses, is actually closer to the system of monarchy, which we recently discussed. It is a single ruler that all the people of Israel need to listen to, who God will pick. And interestingly, Moses said that the king who God picks is going to be from among their brothers. They can't have any king who's not from among their brothers. And then here, Moses says, Adonai, your God, will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. Mm. So as we were talking before with the kings, God picked a ruler. He picked David. He picked his line, which ultimately finds its fulfillment in Yeshua. But if he gave David an eternal covenant of kingship, and he also appointed a prophet mediator that the people of Israel need to listen to, and both of these wield singular authority from God, then they both need to be the same person. Mm. Israel needs a prophet, a mediator, a king who has God's words in his mouth and who will command and teach the people his ruling.
Now, one other thing that I want to point out before we move on from the section about the prophet like Moses is that Moses has made it a command to listen to and obey the prophet like Moses. And as we just established, the prophet like Moses is the Messiah, the Master Yeshua. So this means that it is literally a Torah command from Moses to obey and listen to Yeshua. This means that any Jew who is not listening to Yeshua is in violation of Torah. The Master Yeshua essentially says as much to the Jews, to the leaders who were opposing him in John, when he says, "You search the scriptures because you think to have life everlasting in them. But these are they that are testifying about me, and you do not want to come to me so that you may have life. Do not think that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one who is already accusing you, Moshe, in whom you have hoped. Indeed, if you were believing Moshe, you would have been believing me, for he wrote about me. But if you do not believe his writings, how will you believe my sayings?" So Yeshua is really bold here. He says emphatically, Moses wrote about me. And if you don't believe in me, then Moses is the one who's going to accuse you. Moses has already written the Torah and given you the command to listen to me. And so you're not listening to me, and you stand judged because of the Torah. As Yeshua also says, he came to fulfill the words of the Torah and the prophets. Everything that they say about the prophet like Moses, about the king of Israel, about the Messiah, about the chosen mediator, about the new covenant, all of that points to Yeshua. And so when we reject Yeshua, we're rejecting the testimony of Moses and the prophets that testifies about Yeshua. The fullness of Jewish faith cannot come unless we accept the Messiah that our Jewish scriptures teach us about. And that Messiah is Yeshua. He's the prophet like Moses. He's the mediator. He's the king. And everything that they say is fulfilled in him. And if we believe in him, then we can be saved. And he will lead us as Moses led us, as David led us, and he will lead us to everlasting life.
So moving on from here, Moses talks about the role of witnesses in confirming and punishing people's crimes. This applies to several contexts, like distinguishing between a murderer who needs to be put to death or a manslayer who can be safe in the city of refuge. And then also anyone who follows after other gods or breaks the covenant or serves idols, all those people who are doing abominations in God's sight need to be put to death, but only on the evidence of witnesses. As Moses says, a single witness shall not suffice against any person for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses shall a charge be established. So Moses has already talked in a lot of places and reaffirmed here that there are things, there are crimes that people can do which warrant death because they're so bad. But Moses is providing a safeguard here against false witnesses. There can't be any one accusation resulting in a person being put to death. It has to be confirmed by multiple witnesses. When multiple independent witnesses all verify something they have seen, then that confirms that it is true. And not only true, but needs to be acted upon. And so what Moses is showing here is that there is power in the testimony of witnesses, power to punish and to destroy. In fact, Moses specifically says that when someone has been following after other gods, that person needs to be stoned to death with stones, and the witnesses need to be the first in putting that person to death. And so it's a way of showing that it is the witnesses who are putting him to death, literally, but by their testimony also. It is their testimony which is confirming you committed a capital offense. You are being put to death by the word and by the stones and by the hand of these witnesses. But then Moses also says that that power to destroy can be reflected back on you if you use it wrong. Because if there is a false witness, Moses says, the judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. So you shall purge the evil from your midst, and the rest shall hear and fear, and never again commit any such evil among you. So if a person uses the power of their testimony to be a false witness instead of a true witness, then their power to put a person to death can result in their own being put to death. If they accuse someone else of a capital offense and it turns out that they were accusing falsely, then that is a capital offense. They need to be put to death. And so this shows just how important testimony is, how valuable and powerful it is. And so as Moses says, on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, a charge will be established. Anything can be confirmed and acted upon based on these witnesses because there is authority and power in that. And the Master Yeshua actually calls attention to this power and authority of witnesses to confirm his own authority. In the passage which we've already just talked about in John 5, he says, "If I alone testify about myself, my testimony is not true, but there is another who is testifying about me, and I have known that the testimony that he testifies about me is true. You have sent to Yochanan, and he has testified to the truth. But I have the testimony greater than that of Yochanan. Indeed, the acts that the Father has given me, so that I might complete them, the acts themselves that I do, they testify about me, that the Father has sent me. And the Father who sent me, he has testified about me. You search the scriptures, because you think to have life everlasting in them. But these are they that are testifying about me. And again, as we already said, if you were believing Moshe, you would have been believing me, for he wrote about me." So more than two or three witnesses, Yeshua calls on a whole host of witnesses to confirm his authority. He testifies about himself. Yochanan the Immerser testified about him. His miracles testify about him. The Father testifies about him. And the scriptures testify about him. Moses' own words, the ones we just read, that God would raise a prophet like him from among his brothers, those are a witness that testify about Yeshua. And so they have authority to confirm the matter that Yeshua is the Messiah. He is the prophet like Moses. He has authority from God. And we need to listen to what he says.
Now, I also wanted to go to another teaching of Yeshua, which builds on this command in Torah, which talks about two or three witnesses. In Matthew 18, Yeshua exhorts his disciples, "And if your brother sins against you, go show him his fault between you and him alone. If he hears you, you gained your brother. But if he does not hear, take with you one or two more, so that by the mouth of two witnesses or three, every word will stand. And if he does not hear them, then say it to the called forth. And if he also does not hear the called forth, then let him be to you as the goy foreigner and the tax gatherer." So here Yeshua is taking what Moses said and applying it to sin between believers. The first step is to go to someone and confront them individually, just the two of you by yourselves alone. Try and settle it without getting anyone else involved. If your brother hears you, then your relationship is restored and you're good to go, and then you don't need to get anyone else involved. Proverbs says, "He who is trustworthy conceals a matter." So basically, if there's a sin there and it doesn't need to go beyond the two of you, then don't get anyone else involved. Keep it between the two of you. But Yeshua says that if that's not enough, Then you bring two or three witnesses and try to confront him again. So this brings more weight with you, more weight to try and confront the guy. But also it says, by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word will stand. So basically, these witnesses can then confirm that this person is actually being in sin if things continue to progress. It's only after you bring two or three witnesses and he still hasn't repented and turned from his sin that you can then bring the entire called forth, the entire assembly of believers into the matter. You can't do that without having first done the two or three witnesses, because then you're the only one testifying about that sin. And so it's just one witness, and you can't punish someone just based on the testimony of one witness. You have to have those two or three witnesses along with you, so that way, if things continue to progress, then the entire called forth will have the testimony necessary to do what is right, to punish that person if they're still not turning from their sin. So next in Deuteronomy 20, Moses moves on to talk about how the people of Israel are supposed to wage war against their enemies, both at home and abroad. Moses starts out by saying that whenever they go out to war, they shouldn't be afraid of their enemies. We've seen this over and over again throughout the Torah and specifically in the book of Deuteronomy, that God is fighting for the people of Israel. And so if they're facing their enemies, they don't need to be afraid. They just need to trust in God. And so right here, Moses says that the priests are supposed to remind the armies of Israel of this before they go out to war. Anytime they go out to war, the priests encourage the people by saying, listen, don't be afraid. Adonai is the one fighting for you, and Adonai is the one who will give your enemies into your hands. And additionally, Moses says that after the priests give this exhortation, that the officers and commanders in the Israeli army are supposed to go through the army and start dismissing people based on certain qualifications. If there's any Israeli soldier who has a new house and he hasn't dedicated it yet, or if he has a new vineyard and he's never gotten the fruit of that vineyard before, or if he's engaged to a woman and he hasn't married her yet, if a soldier is in any of these positions, then he gets sent home straight away. He doesn't get to fight. Additionally, the officers say, all right, is anyone here afraid? If anyone's afraid, you can just go home. And so in that way, the Israeli army will be smaller, but at the same time, everyone who's there will be acting in accordance with God's commands, and they will be trusting in God. It's very similar to what we read in the book of Judges when Gideon was gathering an army to defeat the Midianites, and God told Gideon, you need to start sending soldiers away, because otherwise the Israeli army will trust in themselves and think we got this victory for ourselves rather than God giving the victory to Israel. And so the first thing that Gideon does is he sends away everyone who was afraid. And so out of their army of some 30,000 guys, 22,000 of them were afraid and they all went home. And then after that, God told Gideon, have all the remaining 10,000 soldiers go and drink water from the river. And whoever gets down on all fours and starts lapping out of the river with his tongue like a dog, those are the soldiers that you're going to use to defeat Midian. And so after that, there were only 300 soldiers left out of the entire army of like 32,000 guys. And God used those 300 water-lapping, dog-like soldiers in order to defeat the people of Midian. And in that way, God made sure to show, I'm the one fighting for Israel. I'm the one who gives victory to Israel. I'm the one who saves Israel. Israel is not winning on their own strength. And so Moses is saying here, anytime that they fight, they need to remember this. Anytime that they fight, they need to be fighting in accordance with God's commands and remember that he is their God, he is their king, and he is the one who gives them victory.
Another thing that's worth noting here is that Moses specifically says that they need to send the people who are afraid home, saying, let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. So Moses is specifically saying that all the fearful people need to go home because they could make the other people afraid. We've already talked before a lot of times about how the people you associate with can corrupt you. This applies to the people of Israel when they go in among the nations, how they need to not associate with those nations or they'll copy their idolatrous ways. And then also, we saw something similar back in the book of Numbers when the 10 spies who brought the bad report, because of their own doubt, they made all the other people's hearts melt. The same language that Moses puts here. Made them afraid so that they rebelled and refused to enter the land. So just a few bad apples, as it were, a few doubting people can spread doubt like a contagion among the people. And so Moses is saying it is better for the people who are afraid to stay home than to make the other people afraid. If you are going to not have faith in God and instead be overcome by fear and doubt, it is better for you to stay home than to go and follow and fight for God. Yeshua said to people who weren't willing to give up everything to follow him, "You can't be my disciple." They would say, "I want to follow you," and he would say no and send them home. If you are going to follow God, you have to be sold out. You have to be ready and willing and unafraid to give your life. And if you are courageous, if you are willing to fight and give your life for God, then he will be with you, he will fight for you, and he will give you victory. So after Israel has refined their army and sent away a bunch of people like is described here, then they go out to war and fight against their enemies. And so Moses actually gives separate instructions depending on whether the people of Israel are going to fight an enemy who's far away or whether they're fighting the enemies in the land, that is the Canaanites that they're going to conquer and possess their territory. Basically, if they're going to fight an external enemy, Moses sets out the rules for war as being pretty basic and fairly lenient. They go up against the cities, and first they offer terms of peace. They say, "We don't have to fight you. If you surrender, then you guys can just be our servants, and we won't do you harm. But if the men of the city refuse and instead prepare to fight, then Israel is to place the city under siege. And when they break through the city, then they kill all the male soldiers. But the women and the children and the spoil, they can take all that, they can spare them alive and enjoy them as plunder for themselves." So these are the general rules for when Israel is going out to fight their neighbors. These rules do not apply when they're driving out the Canaanites. Moses makes sure to reaffirm here. He says, "As I've already told you, as God commanded you, drive them all out, put them all to death, destroy their cities, do not spare any spoil, lest they turn you away to follow other gods." So this once again reaffirms what we've already said a bunch of times, which is that Israel cannot allow these corrupting influences in their midst.
Finally, this portion wraps up with Moses telling the people of Israel what they do if they find a person who's been murdered and they don't know who killed him. As we said before, the penalty for murder is death. And so the murderer needs to be found and he needs to be killed by the next of kin avenger. In the case that Moses outlines here, though, they find a dead body and they have no idea who killed him. He's just been dumped out in a field somewhere outside the city and they don't know what happened. So what Moses instructs in this case is for the elders of the nearest Israeli city to go and get the priests. And then they're all supposed to meet at a stream and they're supposed to bring a heifer that hasn't ever been worked for plowing or anything like that. And they take the heifer and they break its neck. And then the elders are supposed to wash their hands over the dead heifer and basically confess to God, "Forgive us, forgive your people, Israel. We don't know who's guilty of bloodshed, but please forgive us. We don't know who did it." And so the priests, basically, they stand as witnesses as the elders are doing this, just to make sure that everything is done correctly. And at that point, God says, "So you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the eyes of Adonai." So Moses is basically saying that even if there's nothing that the elders of Israel can do, they have no idea who's the murderer, they have no idea who to punish, there's still something that they do need to do, which is they need to confess there was sin that happened in Israel, please forgive us, and then God will see that and he won't count that sin against Israel. Israel isn't allowed to just be flippant when someone gets murdered and no one knows who did it. It's not enough for them to say, "Oh, we did everything we could and now let's just forget about it." There was still sin there and they still need to bring it to God. And so I think that a good principle that can be drawn from this is that we should always bring everything to God. Even if everything is out of our control, we still need to present that to God and still say, "Look, this is out of my control. God, I'm trusting you." And basically, even if there's nothing you can do, don't just be flippant about it. Don't just ignore it. Whatever we do or don't do, God is always watching our attitude. He's not just watching our actions, but he's watching what's in our hearts. And so even if there's nothing that we can do, even if there is no action that we can take, our hearts still need to be right with God and we still need to bring everything. Every single thing, no matter what happens, we need to bring it to God.
So I think the big takeaway from this portion is do not follow any voice except the one that speaks the words of God. As Moses instructed the people to appoint judges over them, he gave them the command to be impartial and render justice and only justice, to stick to God's commands alone, not be swayed by any bribe or any other force. They need to only be listening to one voice, and that is the voice of the words of God. In turn, Moses instructed the people that they need to listen to the priests and the judges who declare the words of God. They are to render decisions based on God's word, and in so doing, they are a voice of God's word and God's law, and Israel needs to listen to them. So also the king needs to know God's Torah and have that voice continually leading him and not be led astray by any other possessions. But most importantly, Moses calls on the people of Israel to listen to the prophet like him, the one whom God puts his words in his mouth to teach and command the people of Israel all of God's words. That is the one that Israel needs to listen to above all, and the one we need to listen to as well, the Master Yeshua, who came in the name of his Father to speak the words of his Father, to teach us and to lead us with God's voice. We need to be faithful in pursuing him with our whole hearts, not be drawn astray to any other possession or desire or incentive, and instead focus on his words alone and focus on the words of God, which he has spoken through his Torah and written down by the testimony of multiple witnesses. Every word of God is true, and every one of them witnesses to the way we should go and the one we should follow, the Master Yeshua. So let us be willing to give up everything, not be afraid, be bold and courageous and willing to give up our own lives for the Master's cause, so that we will follow him wholeheartedly and listen to his voice alone.
That wraps up the portion of Shoftim. Next week, we'll be looking at the portion of Ki Tetzeh, so be sure to tune in for that. Thanks so much for watching. Be sure to like, share, comment, subscribe, and hit the notification bell to keep updated on new videos. And if you would, please consider sending us a donation to help us make more videos like these. We would really appreciate it. Thanks again for watching, and we'll see you next week. God bless.